From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You want to take a walk? Let's head outside, down the street, around the corner, away from the traffic, and into the woods. Trees arch overhead, leaves rustle, birds call. There's something almost primeval about a forest, don't you think? Something enchanting, magical even.
The forest is mysterious and trackless and pathless, endangering but also kind of thrilling. Some of the earliest myths that we have revolve around a sacred wood, a sacred forest.
It's the trees, it's the animals, it's the understory, the plants. I have a friend who says you should really think of a forest more as a verb than as a noun.
Stories about woods and forests today, beginning with a Tennessee biologist who recently set himself an unusual challenge to spend a year visiting and observing 1 square meter of forest every day. David Haskell lives in Sewanee. He's a contemplative scientist, and he's just written a beautiful book of essays called The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature.
I chose the square meter by walking through the woods until I found a rock on which I thought I could sit comfortably for a year. And the area in front of that rock became the focal area for the observation. It was a place I'd never seen before. I had no idea of its potential as a place for salamanders or wildflowers or anything else.
This 1 square meter of forest, you call it a mandala. Why?
A mandala in Tibetan Buddhism is a representation of the entire universe. Usually this is made by monks from colored sand. I took that as the guiding metaphor for this book and regarded my 1 square meter as a forest mandala. One of the purposes of both is to focus the attention through repeated acts of the will, return the attention to one small area and thereby see the whole world. January 17th, ankle-deep snow has smoothed the forest into a gentle swell and trough. I brush the snow from my rock. The sun emerges and snow transforms from a soft layer of white into thousands of sharp, bright points of light. I hook a fingertip of this glittering jumble. Seen closely, the snow is a tangle of mirrored stars, each flake revealing perfectly symmetrical arms, needles, and hexagons. Hundreds of these exquisite ice flakes crowd onto one fingertip. How is such beauty born?
So tell me about that day when you found the spot. You found a rock you could sit on comfortably, more or less, for a year, and you saw in front of you a square meter of forest floor. What was there? What did you see that day?
The square meter is ringed by a series of tumbled sandstone boulders that have rolled down from the cliff that sits at the top of the mountain slope. And those boulders are covered with dozens of species of lichens and mosses. And then within that circle of rocks is a sort of fairly deep layer of leaf litter with, depending on the season, various creatures scurrying around. I began this observation in the middle of winter, but even then there were quite extraordinary creatures. There was a nematomorph, which is also known as a Gordian worm, which is a little parasitic worm lying right at the center of the 1 square meter. It turns out this worm had escaped from the body of a cricket weeks before and was looking for a mate. So on a fairly dull day in January, just by focusing my visual senses on the forest, many different creatures popped into my consciousness.
I'm curious about the acoustic. I mean, obviously, I work in radio, so I care about sounds. But what sounds did you hear, do you hear, in that spot, in your square meter of the world?
The expansion of my acoustic sense was one of the more unexpected outcomes of this year's watch in the forest. My PhD thesis was on bioacoustics. I made sound recordings of birds out in the woods, and so I'm quite well attuned to soundscapes. And yet I had not realized until I'd really paid attention the extent to which all the animals in the forest are listening to one another and are tied together in an acoustic network. It's sort of like Facebook, except run through the animal's ears. and they're always on Facebook. And that realization came to me when I startled the deer. I was sitting so still that the deer walked right up to me and almost collided with me before it ran away, making an alarm snorting sound. And as it left, I heard the chipmunks pick up the alarm, and then the squirrels in the trees, and then down the slope a wood thrush started alarm calling. And a wave of alarm spread out through the forest, and it took an hour for that wave to die down.
The other thing about what you just said is how still you managed to be in the neighborhood of your little piece of land, because there's another section talking about a moth landing on your arm, I think.
Yes. Being quiet is a key that will unlock a lot of the observations out in nature. And it's not just naturalists. It's not just me who found this out. Hunters know this. People who've gone out over hundreds of years, thousands of years to try and experience nature have found that just shutting up for a little while is a good thing. And part of our inheritance as primates is that we're very loud and noisy. If you've been around wild monkeys in tropical areas, they're always chattering to one another and squabbling. So I don't think it's just a product of modernity. I think this is who we are as a species, and it does take a deliberate act of the will to quiet that down, stop jiggling around, stop talking, and just listen for a while. And if we do that, we can sink into some of these quieter networks and see how the creatures are connected one to another. April 14th, a moth shuffles its tawny feet over my skin, tasting me with thousands of chemical detectors. Six tongues. Every step is a burst of sensation. Walking across a hand or a leaf must be like swimming in wine, mouth open. My vintage meets the moth's approval, so his proboscis unfurls. I feel cool wetness as the moth slaps the tip around, seeming to search something out. I lean towards my finger, squinting through a hand lens in time to see the tip worm itself into the groove between two ridges of my fingerprint.
E.O. Wilson says of your book that it's an example of a new kind of nature writing located between science and poetry. What does it mean to try to bring those two modes of perception together?
I was honored that he said such kind things about my work. For me, science and poetry are not different things. Science is an application of the poet's desire to see the world and to revel in that world. I do think that there is a very strong parallel between the written word and how forest ecosystems work. Ecosystems are all built on relationships. For me, the miracle of the written word is that it connects our consciousnesses up. So when you read something I've written, when I read something someone else has written, the deepest part of ourselves, the center of our consciousness, is connected to another person's consciousness, and thereby we grow and change. And to me, that's a very ecological process. So walking into a bookstore is like walking into a forest. You can hear all these voices coming from different sides, all interacting in complicated and unpredictable ways.
I can see how a scientist reading poetry might change the way you do your science, I guess. It's as though if you can see poetic connections, it might lead you to scientific connections.
Absolutely. And I think all the best scientists have realized that, and whether they regard themselves as poets or read much poetry is beside the point. The key is to see beyond the surface, and that's what poetry does, and that's what science does, is push us is beyond just the superficial appearance of things, dive down into the meaning underneath patterns that we see either in the world or in language.
Of course, you did things in the course of this year of watching this square meter of land that I suspect are not taught in science classes, and I'm not sure it's poetic either. There was a day when you saw a bird. It was 20 below zero, and the bird was shivering, and I got the impression you decided that you would see what that felt like, so you pulled off all your clothes. 20 below zero, that's a crazy thing to do.
Well, you could look at that as an artistic installation in the woods. It was a very short-lived one, yeah. My desire was to experience the world as these animals experienced it, unmediated by clothes or other technological aids in the forest. So it was the coldest day of the year. It was a very cold wind chill coming through. So I just stripped off in the woods and lasted about a minute. And then I was shivering so bad, and in fact, it wasn't just a physiological reaction. It was a psychological reaction. I was deeply alarmed by what was happening to my body. And so I tried to dress as quickly as I could. My hands were so numb I could barely hold the clothes or hold the zippers. Mm. And then to look at the little chickadee that was dancing in the trees above me with new eyes. That is just amazing, that this little bird that weighs just as much as 3 pennies can live through this cold day after day after day with no supermarket, no furnace in the home, and so on. And I can last a minute. How do they do that?
Well, it really brought to life for me the energy involved in what the chickadee needs in order to survive. Something, what did you say, 65,000 joules to last?
They need a phenomenal amount of energy intake each day, and each little insect or spider egg that they can find is just a tiny fraction of that. That's why when you walk in the woods, the little chickadees are always active. They are on the edge of survival. And in fact, many of them, up to half of them, don't make it through the winter because they haven't managed to find enough insects. That's also why they like bird feeders, because a big, fat, oily sunflower seed is just an amazing gift. So we bribe them in. We bribe these little gray flames into our lives with our bird feeders.
This whole year of observation must have been a humbling experience like that in some ways, wasn't it? I mean, your 1 square meter of forest had so many things you didn't know. You must have thought you did when you went in.
Like all humbling experiences, yeah, you wind up knowing the extent of your limitations. One of the limitations was the extent of my knowledge. I had a strong sense at the end of this year that I had just scratched the surface. And there were thousands of creatures here that I would never be able to know or name because nobody has ever studied them. And let alone know or name them, but understand how they all interact in the great drama of life. So that was part of the limitation, was limitation of knowledge. The other was a limitation of my being able to even imagine how these other lives were playing out. For example, for birds, birds see an extra color that we don't have. So we have three. They have four. So they have colors that aren't even in the possibility of us being able to place in our minds. And so here I am living in basically a different world, a different sensory world than these creatures. And yet somehow we're all tied in this physical universe together. So that's an interesting tension to me, is the separation and the unity that we see in nature. That when I look at a tree or a snail, that's my cousin. Literally, we trace our ancestry back and we come to the same family, the same little cell that split into two lineages many billions of years ago. One lineage led to me and one led to that oak tree. To me, that's a remarkable thing. And it sort of expands my mind out and realizes that this is one big family. April 16th, sunrise birds. A peach stain soaks into the darkness on the eastern horizon. Then the whole dome of the sky lightens, bleeding from darkness to pale luminosity. Two repeated notes ring through the air. The first is clear and high. The second is lower and emphatic. These tufted titmice keep up their rapid two-part rhythm as a Carolina chickadee starts a whistled melody. Four notes that fall and rise like a nodding head. The peach spreads up from the horizon, and a Phoebe calls with a whiskey and cigarette roughened voice, rasping out its name, Frebir, like a broken blues man.
And a blackbird singing in the dead of night. dig my sunken eyes and learn to see. And all your life you're only waiting for this moment to be free.
David Haskell is an award-winning professor of biology at the University of the South. He lives in Suwanee, Tennessee, where he and his wife also run a homestead, raising goats and selling milk. He's the author of The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature. We head north next, into the hardwood forests of Vermont, and later, deep into the woods of myth and fairy tale. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You didn't expect us to get through a whole hour on woods and forests without quoting Robert Frost, did you? The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. It's from his famous poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Frost lived in Vermont, and that's where we go next. Anne's taking a walk with Stephen Long, the founder of Northern Woodlands Magazine. He and his wife live on 95 acres in central Vermont.
You moved here when? How long have you been here?
We've been here since 1988. It was a chance to really spend time with owning a piece of land, which is a whole different thing for us. Mary and I met in Santa Fe, and so it was...
a pretty different landscape.
Very different landscape. And so we were anxious to come back home. Oh. Yeah.
And you said owning a piece of land, managing a woods like this is different from, I guess, just walking through it or vacationing there. What's different?
What's different is you it's readily accessible every day. I know these woods so well by now after more than 20 years of being in them. I know where I am every second of the way. And you get off the trail, which is, you don't when, in fact, you're discouraged from getting off the trail when you're hiking. And so who knows what the woods are like even 50 feet into the woods. To me, getting out between the trails and seeing what's out there is what's really exciting about it.
Well, let's walk in yours a little bit. Show me what you see.
Okay, that's great. So here, this started out as a pine forest, and it's younger than a lot of the other forests that we'll walk through.
Now, somebody told me that if you go back, I don't know, 100 years or something, there were hardly any trees in Vermont. That can't be true. I think of it as America's northern woodland.
It's absolutely true. And, well, it was forest when European settlers arrived. Progress is agriculture in our culture. And we settled this land, and we took down all of the forest. So 95% forest when European settlers arrived. By 1840, it was probably 20% forest. And as the West got opened up, there was a whole-scale farm abandonment. And so now it's reversed. It's about 80% forest now.
It's sort of comforting to know that these woods probably didn't exist 100 years ago, and yet now look at them.
Yeah, you wouldn't. People walking in here would assume that this is an old growth forest, and it's so far from it. I mean, it's a 75-year-old forest, and forests are incredibly dynamic. They're always changing. One tree gets cut down, others come in its place.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go up, and I want to show you this. There's a small line of trees here. There's no flat ground in Vermont, as far as I can tell. Very steep.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so these are a couple hundred years old. It's amazing that they're still standing. It's probably, a 40-inch diameter tree, something like that. It's a sugar maple.
Now, this tree is really old and it's got some life in it still, but when it finally does die and doesn't have many more leaves, will you cut it down?
No, it'll die in place, and you'll see right there on the ground, there's some that's fallen. Here's some more. There's just tons of life in here. Here's the inside of this old tree, and it's just teeming with life. If you sit really still and just let things happen, I've seen fishers come, and they'll just walk up that trunk, just listening and smelling and looking to see. They know that a trunk like that on the ground is a magnet for small animals, and they're always looking for food. That's their job.
And all of this, I suppose, if you just went for a hike in the woods, you wouldn't see. You really have to either own or get to know a piece of land intimately to see that kind of life.
With us talking, we're making sure that we don't see anything. The birds don't mind. You can still hear birds around. Over there, if you can hear that fluty thing, that's the hermit thrush, and that's that. I'll shut up, and you can... Yeah, that's a hermit thrush.
That was a mosquito. A lot of people who care about the environment, I think, would say that the best thing for nature, for the environment, would be for the humans just to leave it alone. So would the forest be healthier if you did nothing to it, just left it alone? What would happen to it?
There are certain places that are so fragile that I think a hands-off policy is a good thing. But humans need wood. We use a lot of wood in our daily life. You could take 1% of this a year and use it for fuel, sell it for lumber, for paper. If everything is off limits, then we're going to export the need for producing products to places where there are not good environmental ethics behind the harvesting. And so we would just be exporting the need. I really, really believe in people using their land, using it well. And cutting trees done well is a perfectly good use of the woods.
So what else do you notice when you walk around the woods?
One of the things, we're standing right here where there's some exposed bedrock. And one of the things that makes the soil here particularly fertile and particularly good for growing sugar maples is that we have this bedrock that has a lot of calcium in it. It flakes very easily. You know, this is just, it's ready to break off. It's ready to melt into the ground. You just get a little rainwater on that, and all of these nutrients go into the soil. If you compare that to New Hampshire, which has a granite bedrock, it does not erode well, and so it doesn't give up its nutrients. So the core of the soil there is nowhere near as fertile.
So does that mean Vermont's woods are better than New Hampshire's woods?
Well, of course. Of course. Look at that other big tree there. See the base of it?
Yeah, that kind of hole.
Yeah. Doesn't that look like if you're looking for shelter, wouldn't you automatically go there if you would fit into that?
I mean, it looks like an inviting little doorway.
It does. Maybe we should go and see if there's anything in it. We might just see signs that something's in there. Oh, and you can smell it. Smell that. I mean, it smells like there's urine around here. If you put your nose in, you might not want to, but it definitely, there's life here. So I was just thinking that this tree is probably 200 years old. I just think of how many generations of animals have spent time in there, have found that to be great shelter for them.
Hmm. Yeah. So I wanted to, there's another, we're part of the ecosystem too, and you're living out a portion of your life cycle here with your woods, caring for your land and walking in your woods. I'm curious about how that's affected your inner life, how you've changed over the years by living close to the land this way.
Well,
it's kind of a big question.
It is a big question. I'd like to think that it allows me to be more appreciative of the natural cycle of things, that it has helped me understand that life and death is all part of an endless cycle. Some things thrive in the circumstances in which something else died. A tree that falls provides room for something else to grow. Life and death are all part of the same thing, and understanding that, my understanding of that really is a result of spending time in the woods and looking at it directly on a day-to-day basis. So it can, if you feel like spending time philosophizing, there's plenty of rich veins right here in the woods.
Stephen Long, talking with Ann Strainchamps. He's the founder of Northern Woodlands Magazine, and he's just published an ecological guide to managing a forest. It's called More Than a Woodlot. You'll find links and photos and other good stuff on our website at ttbook.org. Oh, and all that bird song reminds me, to the best of our knowledge, is tweeting now, so come find us. The woods may be lovely, dark, and deep, but they can also be dangerous. In the old stories, mothers are always telling their children not to go into the woods. Of course, we're still telling those stories. We'll celebrate the 25th anniversary of Stephen Sondheim's landmark musical Into the Woods in just a bit. But first, in a new book of essays called When Women Were Birds, nature writer Terry Tempest Williams writes about a terrifying experience she had years ago when she wandered into the woods with the wrong person. This was in Idaho's Sawtooth Wilderness. Steve Paulson says it's one of the scariest stories he's read.
I had seen him around. He was striking, 30-something, tan, blonde, and fit. If you saw him once, you would remember him again. I did remember him. I felt as though I had been carrying a part of him around the edges of my attention. So when he appeared, it was as though he came to retrieve what was his. "My name is Joseph," he said. "Would you like to go for a walk?" "I'm working," I said. "I don't have the time." We were both staying at a remote camp in the Sawtooth Wilderness of Idaho. I was a teaching assistant for a field ecology course. He was doing carpentry work. "There's a nice view up at Two Ravens at Tall Pine," he said. I nodded, continuing to write. I knew the ridge. I didn't need to go with him. The smell of him was smoke laced with sweat. Even in the breeze of the screened porch of the ranch house, he was a reminder of campfires in dry, hot country. Even his hands were dusty. "I'll have you back by dinner." I looked up. He looked down at my moccasins. "Put on your hiking boots." I don't know why I ignored my body's instincts, my own intuition. It all had the ingredients of an ill-fated story. Mimi had read us Andersen's and Grimm's fairy tales backward and forward. I preferred Grimm's because they were darker, scarier, more trustworthy. The box set of green and red books were tattered and worn. We all had our favorites. I always wanted to hear the story of Snow White. I liked the idea of a talking mirror and the wicked queen obsessed with her own fading beauty and threatened by her endless question, "Who is the fairest of them all?" Disguised, she tries three times to kill Snow White, first with corset laces so tight they cause her to faint, second with a poisoned comb, and third with a poisoned apple. But Snow White always managed to escape death and return to life, foiling her wicked stepmother. For me, it became a love story of Snow White and the prince, how to remain hidden yet have your powers known and survive what threatens you. The seven dwarfs seemed credible to me, growing up in a large extended family where each member provided and protected one another with their own eccentricities. Joseph wore me down. It was easier to say yes than to say no. I put my pen and papers down, put on my hiking boots, and followed him. "How bad can this be?" I thought. "The fresh air will do me some good."
So you went off with him into the woods with this strange man. What happened?
You know, even just reading that passage, My heart is in my throat. I just feel physically sick. You know, and this is a case where I had not written this in my journal ever. I have told very few people. When it happened, I told Brooke by way of a letter.
Brooke, your husband.
The next day, I don't know how many miles I hiked down to the highway and handed someone a quarter and this letter to mail. What happened was, I don't even know how to say. I guess the bottom line is, after we had been walking and I left and he came back half clothed.
You say he was wearing only a loincloth at one point.
I mean, it's so humiliating, I have to tell you. I mean, how completely stupid was I? And, you know, when he arrived wearing little, with green visqueen wrapped around his forehead, I just thought, this is the most insane thing I've ever seen. And then I thought, either this is hilarious or this is just pitiful and let's just get going. Well, I left. We were walking. All of a sudden, I realized we are going nowhere. In fact, there's nowhere to get out of this. I saw this huge ravine below us, Richardson's Creek. I turned around, and there was Joseph standing behind me with a double-edged axe. And in that moment, you know how time stops? I don't know how many seconds, but I saw his eyes dilated black. And I'll tell you what came into my mind quickly was, oh my God, I'm going to be murdered. I cannot be murdered. What would that do to Brooke? What would that do to my parents? And then immediately I remembered a passage from Barry Lopez's book, Of Wolves and Men. He talked about the conversation of death between a wolf and its prey. And if it was a caribou or a moose, there was a conversation, death, I will not be taken. Or if it was a sheep, a domesticated animal, that animal would not have eye contact, and therefore the wolf would go crazy. And I remember all this just in split-second time, and I remember looking at Joseph, and I thought, I refuse to be taken. I will not be taken. And at that moment, he slipped, and I ran, and I never looked back.
And you say, at one point, I mean, going back to the reference to fairy tales, bad things happen to women in the woods.
And I didn't tell anyone, Steve. I didn't tell my professor. I didn't tell any of the students.
How old were you then?
I was in my late 20s, mid-20s. Mm-hmm. Why didn't I tell anyone? I didn't want to defame his character. I thought maybe I was wrong. Maybe it was my fault. It's incomprehensible to me now. And yet I don't think this is an isolated story. I think there's many women who have gone through something similar. Whether it was rape, whether it was abuse, whether it was almost being murdered. You know, who do we protect? And I think about Audre Lorde, your silence will not protect you. And I think about the other women that this man may have hurt, murdered, raped. I don't know. It haunts me still.
Your silence. Your silence haunts you.
The consequences of my silence, which became my complicity.
Do you have any idea whatever happened to this man, Joseph?
I don't. And even as you and I speak, you know, I think, is he out there? Is he listening? It still terrifies me.
Yeah.
Terry Tempest Williams, talking with Steve Paulson. Terry's new book is called When Women Were Birds.
I went into the woods today to see what I could find. I saw a fox and he told me to run away and hide.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
For thousands of years, people have been telling dark, scary stories about the woods. First in myths and legends, later in fairy tales and folklore. Hansel and Gretel, Red Riding Hood, Beauty and the Beast. They all came to grief wandering in forests. Or rather, the forest, the enchanted forest, the magical woods, where all the fairy tales and myths and legends take place. To find out why the forest keeps drawing us back, Anne Strangechamps turned to the British scholar Marina Warner.
Well, I think the first thing that one should say is that the forest is mysterious and trackless and pathless, and so has intrinsic qualities that are endangering but also kind of thrilling. I mean, one shouldn't forget that the wood figures very, very strongly in our fairy tales as a place of initiation, where the hero or heroine is tried and proved, where self-discovery takes place. The forest is the arena for that.
Why is that, do you think, though? What is it about forests that seems to symbolize the arena for initiation?
Well, I think that in some cases, symbols are rooted in the actual intrinsic properties of the emblem. Forests did cover with, you know, thick darkness, thick impenetrable, and they have a life of their own, and they were full of animals. I mean, now, of course, that's vanished, but they were full of the whole bestiary of our imaginations. The wolf, so strong in fairy tale. The bear, also very strong in many fairy tales. The Beauty and the Beast is frequently depicted as a kind of bear.
And it's interesting because so many of the animal figures you're talking about, they come about in stories involving shape-shifting or transformation, which is at the heart of so many fairy tales. You know, the prince becomes a beast, or the animals talk or transform into wizards or witches. Doesn't that sort of suggest that we see the forest as a place that is overflowing with possibility?
Well, the world of fairy tale very often sees continuity between all organic forms. The souls just, you know, move from one form to another. Nothing is really ever quite inanimate. So trees in the forest, like the animals, are kind of sentient and conscious. And, you know, when I was a child, I had picture books, and it was the trees that frightened me. You know, in Arthur Rackham's illustrations, the trees are alive. You know, they have eyes in their trunks, and their twigs, you know, their bony twigs are like fingers. They're reaching out to grab the child.
And don't you think it's also perhaps part of our, kind of deep historic memory? As you said, you know, long time ago, all of Europe and all of this continent were covered with trees and dense, impenetrable forest. It would have been truly scary.
Well, and a lot of people now do believe in the life of trees. Our heir to the throne, Prince Charles, is famous for tree hugging. he's a bit of a New Ager, and he, you know, but certainly believes in the sort of life inside the tree that is, you know, that can be tapped by contact.
Is the wildwood sometimes a locus of sexuality? Thinking about, I don't know, the thicket of thorns that surrounds Sleeping Beauty or Rapunzel.
Yeah, that's a beautiful allusion, yes. Well, I think that connects to the idea that it's a place of sexual initiation. When Little Red Riding Hood goes to take her mother the pot of butter and the cake, you know, she's entering puberty, as it were. I mean, the encounter with the wolf is, in some of the stories, it's quite explicit. They actually have a kind of more of a relationship than when she's simply devoured. And Angela Carter famously drew that out and has Red Riding Hood sleep happily with the wolf. And then Kiki Smith, the artist, American artist, made a very beautiful sculpture of a little girl with a furry face. Mm-hmm. The sculpture is called Daughter. And she's the daughter of Red Riding Hood and the wolf. Yes. But I suppose you reminded me when you said the thicket of thorns, of a totally different body of illusions, which we should definitely bring in, I think, at this point. And that is that in Norse mythology, where the woods are very, very important because the whole culture depended on wood with their wooden ships, the Vikings, and they imagined a world tree, the Yggdrasil, which grew, right into the bottom fundamental reaches of the world. and our world sat within it, and everything depended on this world tree. Well, the world tree feeds the symbolism of Christ's cross, especially in Northern Europe.
Because wasn't Odin hung on, yes, on that tree?
Exactly. And so Jesus' rood, you know, his cross, is often referred to as a tree.
Well, you know, and art historians often compare the architecture of Gothic cathedrals to forests or trees. They talk about the, you know, seeing the shapes of tree branches reproduced in the elaborate fan vaulting that holds up the ceilings.
Yes, and the light, the beautiful, beautiful way that light is filtered through the stained glass windows, that very much seems to me to reflect the way the forest floor is kind of dappled and slanting rays come through the trees. It's very, very much so.
I mean, so it's as though we've recreated those sacred groves, but in stone.
Yes, I think that's right. Mm.
You know, it's interesting thinking about this whole long history we've been talking about, and the way we so often talk about forests today is we mourn their loss. We talk about the deforestation of the world, and I wonder if what we're really expressing is the sense that we have participated in disenchanting the world.
Yes, and stripping it and plundering it, absolutely. I mean, it is very, very distressing when you still see, you know, mahogany being felled, being sold for kitchen surfaces, and it's very, very appalling.
What we've also cut down is maybe our own connection to a piece of our psyche, the non-rational, enchanted piece of our psyche.
I think that it's one way that one can try and keep literature and literature of myth and fairy tale to the fore as important, because this kind of respect is enshrined in them. One, you know, inhabitant of the forest whom we haven't mentioned so far, but who's very, very important, is the sort of old woman of the forest. In Russia, Baba Yaga lives in the forest in seclusion. She is the old hag whose house runs around on chicken legs, and she is sort of cannibalistic and eats passing children in the forest. But she's also capable of great kindness and sometimes of wisdom. And so she's a sort of counterpart to the, you know, mysterious figure like Grandmother in Red Riding Hood. Why does Grandmother live in the forest, in the depths of the forest, near wolves?
That's a good question. It never occurred to me to wonder what the hell Grandmother was doing living in the forest.
I mean, these old women of fairy tale are often the fairy tale tellers themselves. And as such, she's also, you know, a figure who knows the berries, and she knows the leaves, and she knows how to make the teas. And I mean, so much of the folklore of the past places this kind of figure at the center of midwifery, of different kinds of alternative medicine. And then, of course, once medicine was formalized, which was quite a long time ago, I mean, in the Middle Ages, they became alternative people. I mean, they became marginal, and often, you know, they were condemned. And that's when they start morphing into witches.
Do you think when we do something as ordinary today as take a walk in the woods, some of these many illusions we were playing with are there for us subconsciously at the back of our minds?
There probably are some physiological trace memories to do with, and how a forest of wood will thrill one or inspire kind of fear that, you know, recall when we were kind of animals and hunting for our prey.
Being hunted.
Yeah, or being hunted, exactly. But I think that it's one of the reasons that, you know, we need to keep poetry and song and stories alive in our circulating culture, in our popular culture, is because we haven't really got a way of thinking about these things if we don't have the stories.
Marina Warner writes about art, myths, symbols, and fairy tales. She's a trustee of England's National Portrait Gallery, and her latest book is called Stranger Magic. And Strange Champ spoke with her.
Went for a trip to the Redwood Forest. Mama was at home just praying for us. Went past station and packed our tents. I woke at midnight with sounds in my head.
there's something out there looking around in the midnight air. There's something out there looking around in the midnight air.
What if there really was just one woods where all the fairy tales and myths take place? One magical, enchanted forest where all those characters are wandering around, getting into trouble. We'll put that to music, and you have Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine's landmark musical, Into the Woods. Steve Paulson celebrates its 25th anniversary by talking with Sondheim himself.
Once upon a time,
I wish,
in a far-off kingdom,
more than anything,
lived a fair maiden, a sad young lad,
jewel, I wish,
and a childless baker.
More than life,
I wish, with his
more
wife.
Than anything, more than the moon.
Why did you want to mix together all these classic fairy tales, you know, Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, Jack and the Beanstalk, into one story?
Well, it started out because James Lapine, who wrote the book, and I, after we'd written Sunny the Park with George, I said, let's do another one. He said, what kind of show would you like to do? I said, I'd like to write a quest musical, something along the lines of The Wizard of Oz, some kind of quest with a kind of a fantasy feeling, a fantasy quest. And so James said, how about if, and then he came up with this idea of using characters from different fairy tales, all of whom would meet. And so that's how that came about.
The way is clear, the light is good. I have no fear, nor no one should. The woods are just trees, the trees are just wood. I sort of hate to ask it, but do you have a basket? Into the woods and down the dell, the path is straight, I know it well. Into the woods and who can tell what's waiting on the journey? Into the woods to bring some bread to Granny who is sick in bed. Never can tell what lies ahead, for all that I know she's already dead. But into the woods, into the woods, into the woods, to grandmother's house and home before dark.
And I suppose the setting, the woods, brings another dimension to it, because of course this has its own kind of mythic ancient history.
Well, you know, many folk tales take place in the woods. And, you know, as Bettelheim pointed out, it represents the unconscious. I'm sure there are many other people who've talked about the woods in folk tales. The fact that folk tales have lasted for the number of centuries they have means that they have very large and important metaphoric values to them, or they wouldn't have lasted.
But it's interesting, because in your book, you reflect on, for instance, the sort of the deep meaning of the woods, and you say it's the all-purpose symbol of the unconscious, the womb, the past, the dark place where we face our trials and emerge wiser or destroyed.
Yes, but the key word in that sentence is all-purpose. That's, it represents anything you want it to represent. That's what I was saying. So the point is, it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's irrelevant what it represents because that doesn't affect the telling of the story.
Making the characters come alive, making the characters so you feel like you can connect to them.
Well, character is story. I mean, you know, they're simultaneous. That's all we were concentrating on was story slash character and plot.
Haven't some people responded to the second act of Into the Woods as perhaps too dark? I mean, some of your characters die, and, you know, this goes past the usual telling of a fairy tale.
You know, it depends on which version of fairy tales you hear. You know, when you get the Grimm Brothers versions of certain fairy tales, there's a great deal of blood and weirdness going on. The Grimm version of Cinderella is not the one that everybody knows. The one that everybody knows is the Perrier version, which is a much more whitewashed, pleasant version. But no, folk tales are filled with violence and death.
It's because of you there's a giant in our midst and my wife is dead. But it isn't my fault I was given those beans. You persuaded me to trade away my cow for beans. And without those beans, there'd have been no stock to get up to the giants in the first place. Wait a minute, magic beans for a cow so old that you had to tell a lie to sell it, which you told. Were they worthless beans? Were they all for
Logically, you know, you cut down a beanstalk and a giant falls, it should have a consequence. If you're going to tell this on the stage, it should lead someplace. And James decided that it would lead to the fact that the giant had a wife and that the characters who caused the giant's death had to face the consequences of it.
The I chopped down the beanstalk, right, that's clear. But without any beanstalk, then what's queer is how did the second giant get down here in the first place, second place?
Yeah, how?
Well, who had the other...
I was interested to read that you added a song for the London production, Our Little World, because you wanted to give the witch some maternal feelings for her daughter.
Yeah, since so much of it deals, so much of the plotting deals with her feeling about her daughter, not to show the two of them having a good time together seemed to be cheating, and you had to see some kind of fondness going on instead of just the snarling and the frustration that Rapunzel feels being locked in the tower. So it's a tiny moment, but it was meant to be sort of playful between the mother and daughter.
Our little world is all it needs to be.
Perfect.
Brushing my hair, combing my hair, only my mother and me and my hair. Our little world is perfect. If she just wouldn't drool.
Now, I have heard that one of the more recent productions of Into the Woods was actually set in the woods in London's Regent Park.
Yep.
That must have been kind of magical.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. And there's a good chance that we may do it in Central Park, which would be a swell setting for it. Yeah, there was no stage per se. The entire set was made of trees and twigs and kind of makeshift wooden ladders and platforms that were like parts of the trees and parts of the woods. So the whole thing indeed took place in the woods.
Into the woods! Into the woods! Happy ever after!
I wish!
Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine's musical Into the Woods just celebrated its 25th anniversary. Sondheim talked with Steve Paulson. And now it's time for us to head into the woods, or at least out of the studio. Thanks for listening. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour may be over, but there's more online. Transcripts, book links, extended interviews, and more. Don't forget to friend us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And while you're feeling social, why not share To the Best of Our Knowledge with your friends? It's all online at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of this hour at the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Into the Woods show. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by a bunch of people who actually prefer radio studios to forests, at least sometimes. Anne Strainchamps, Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer, Steve Paulson, likes his trees pulped and turned into books. But our technical director, Kirill Owen, lives in the woods.
PRI, Public Radio International.